how many people know it, but I was an undergraduate at Waterloo long before the perimeter was a glint in anybody's eye. So it's always Old Home Week when I come back here. So this is a somewhat generic title. What I actually hope to tell you about is the description of spacetimes which asymptotically approach Lifshitz geometries and the calculation of quantities in the field theory from the asymptotics in those spacetimes. Although I'll also say something about the Schrodinger case at the end if I have time. This is work. The work that I'm describing was partially performed in collaboration with Omid Suremi about 2 years ago and is partially based on work in progress on my own. So here's an overview of what I'm going to say after giving some motivation and a review of other people's results on these Lifshitz spacetimes. I'll talk about a definition of asymptotically locally Lifshitz spacetimes, and I'll talk about a prescription for calculating the stress tensor in these spacetimes and what the general structure of the boundary geometry for asymptotically locally Lifshitz spacetimes is. I'll give some results for a linearized analysis, which is the work that I did with Omid, and then I'll talk about holographic renormalization in general, how we construct field theory quantities from the bulk asymptotics, and how we deal with the divergences in the usual holographic framework. So let's start with some very general words of motivation about this whole ADS condensed matter business. So the application of holographic methods to gauge theories is now a long-studied subject. We're getting on for 15 years since Maldacena's original paper. Condensed matter has been a much more recent interest. So why is this an interesting thing to do? Well, there are several reasons, as I see it. First of all, this is a rich system. If you're in a condensed matter system, you can often have conformal field theories arising as an infrared description near critical points. And these theories are often strongly coupled, so it's hard to do calculations in them using conventional field theory techniques. So a particular context which has been a focus of interest from the holographic side is this idea of a quantum critical point. So I thought I'd say a few words about that. If you have some phase boundary which extends down to zero temperature, then this zero temperature phase transition is controlled by quantum effects. And you can have a Lorentzian conformal field theory, which is a description of the physics near this fixed point. And what's interesting is that there is then a finite region in the phase diagram where that conformal field theory is a good effective description. If I go up above here, there's a region called the quantum critical region where the thermal effects dominate over detuning effects, over effects of moving away from the critical coupling. So in this quantum critical region, the effective description is in terms of finite temperature excitations of the conformal field theory describing this phase transition. So these conformal field theories are interesting for describing very interesting condensed matter phenomenology, and particularly given that we're interested in studying Lorentzian finite temperature theories, conventional field theory methods like lattice methods are very hard to apply. ADS-CFT provides us with tools for studying strongly coupled field theories using the bulk gravity calculation. So you can use it to do some calculations in conformal field theories in this regime. Furthermore, it provides a different perspective. Unlike most condensed matter methods, the gravity dual calculates observables like transport coefficients directly. It's not based on a quasi-particle and some ballistic approximation. From the point of view of an ADS-CFT merchant of long standing like myself, the interesting aspect of trying to apply it to condensed matter physics is that it prompts new questions. So because you're interested in condensed matter physics, you're driven to consider issues of charge transport and phase transitions, which had been relatively unexplored previously in the holographic literature. So this is the whole holographic superconductor story, which I'm not going to say anything about today. In the condensed matter context, because Lorentz invariance is not a fundamental symmetry, you can also have conformal fixed points where the emergent scaling symmetry is anisotropic, where it treats the time and the space directions differently. And that's what I want to talk about. I want to talk about theories where I have an emergent scaling symmetry but where the spatial directions scale differently from the time directions with some non-unity dynamical critical exponent set. So what do we hope to do? Well, the aim here, I should stress, is not to construct a space-time which is dual to your favorite strongly coupled condensed matter fixed point. I think that's too much to ask at this stage. We don't want to try to make direct contact with the field theory describing cuprate superconductors or with conventional lattice models. And the reason is that the known examples of the duality, the cases where we have the field theory under control, are all large N gauge theories. And there's no sign from the condensed matter side that that's ever the interesting regime. So the idea is really to try to construct examples of strongly coupled field theories which have the qualitative features of interest that are not the conformal field theory that you ordered, but that are in the same class in some sense, and which are tractable from the gravity side. And you can take one of two approaches to that. You can take a fully bottom-up approach where you just try to write down some appropriate classical gravitational Lagrangians such that if you believed it had a dual conformal field theory description, that field theory would have whatever properties you were interested in. Or you can try to be more constraining. You can take a more top-down approach and say, I'm only going to believe something that I can embed into string theory, so I'll only believe, I take my bulk Lagrangian to be string theory or some truncation of it, and look in that context for bulk solutions which have the features of interest. Obviously, a big question which needs to be addressed from the gravity side is, what is the range of theories for which holography is useful? What kinds of things, what classes, can I actually tractably do computations in from the gravity side? Are the lessons that we're learning from these gravitational calculations applicable to a broad enough range of things that they might include the examples that are interesting from the condensed matter side? I think this question is largely open. There has been some interesting progress in understanding what the constraints are in terms of what field theories you can tractably describe using holography. But I think there's a lot more to do here. Okay.
It seems that these two features, large N, which is required for the bulk theory to be weakly coupled, and the hierarchy in the spectrum, neither of these features are qualitatively for typical CFP theoretic condensed matter system.
Indeed. So what you say is, okay, so let me say that I'm interested, for example, in this anisotropic scaling. So there's some space of field theories with anisotropic scaling behavior. And I'm way out at one end of it in the regime of large central charge with this funny hierarchy going on. And there's an interesting question as to how far in I can come from that direction. And I think that's more of a gravity question. How far can I push this? What can I tractably describe in gravity? And there's also an important field theory question, which I'm not the best person to address, which is how much does it matter? In the ADS QCD context, of course, you're faced with the same issue. The field theories you can understand are at large N, and N is 3. But there's some feeling in the QCD community from previous lattice simulations that that's not such a big issue, that that's maybe a 10% effect. Here, I think that's totally open. Okay, so because I want to talk about how this works in this unfamiliar non-relativistic context, I thought first I should remind you of a few aspects of how this works in the familiar ADS context. I assume everybody in the room has some knowledge of ADS-CFT. So we identify the generating function of correlation functions in the field theory, subject to some sources, phi naught for the operators, with the string partition function in the bulk, where the sources are now interpreted as boundary conditions for the bulk fields. So for example, if we look at the stress tensor, which is everybody's favorite operator, there's this beautiful prescription for calculating the stress tensor in general, which is that the stress tensor is the variation of the action with respect to the conformal boundary metric. So there's a beautiful result that I can choose any arbitrary conformal boundary metric I like and write the bulk metric in this series expansion where the leading term is R squared times the conformal boundary metric. So I can calculate this stress tensor by doing this variation. The boundary metric is the source for the stress tensor operator in the field theory. One-point functions for arbitrary sources are all I need to know because I can calculate any correlation function I might be interested in by varying those one-point functions with respect to the sources. So what I really need is an action which has finite variations for boundary conditions fixing any arbitrary conformal boundary metric that I like. So this is understanding the action for asymptotically locally anti-de Sitter spacetimes. Because I'm interested in Lorentzian field theories, the one-point functions will depend on both the sources and the states. And so I also need to understand what the space of asymptotically locally ADS geometries is for a given boundary condition. Once I fix the conformal boundary metric, there's not just one metric in the bulk, but there's some space of metrics. And in particular, thermal states are described by bulk black hole solutions. Okay, so let's turn to now what I'm specifically interested in talking to you about, which is this anisotropic scaling. So we can have theories with an anisotropic scaling symmetry where the time direction scales differently from the spatial directions. There are two broad classes of theories which are interesting. One is what I call Lifshitz-like theories because the first example of a field theory with this symmetry was written down by Lifshitz. And these are where I just have this scaling symmetry, time and space translations, and spatial rotations as the field theory symmetries. The other, which I will discuss briefly at the end if I have time, is Schrodinger symmetry, where I take this and I add some Galilean boosts. So the Lifshitz case has no boost symmetries at all. The Schrodinger case has a non-relativistic boost symmetry. And in that case, z equals 2 is special because it also has a special conformal transformation. So what we're looking for is a holographic description of these classes of theories, focus on the Lifshitz, which has the same ingredients as in the ADS-CFT case. So first, I want to find a spacetime for which these symmetries are isometries. So that will be my background describing the vacuum in the field theory. Then I want to study some space of spacetimes that asymptotically approach that Lifshitz background. So I want to define asymptotically locally Lifshitz spacetimes and give you a prescription for calculating one-point functions for those boundary conditions in terms of the asymptotic falloffs of the bulk fields. And you want to also construct some actual spacetimes satisfying those asymptotic boundary conditions. In particular, you want to find the black hole solutions because that'll describe the interesting finite temperature physics. So one more remark about this symmetry for z equals 1. Obviously, we recover ADS-CFT. For z goes to infinity, the bulk geometry will go to ADS-2 times Rn. In the z goes to infinity limit, I can take the z out of here and put 1 over z there. And in the limit, the scaling symmetry isn't affecting the spatial coordinates. So my perspective on all of this is that this is an interesting example of extending holography. This is an interesting new challenge. Can we find these spacetimes and can we understand the holographic dictionary in this case? So the observable I'm going to focus on again here is the stress energy complex. And the reason I do that is because it's the most generic observable. It's not perhaps the most interesting observable from the condensed matter point of view. You're probably more interested in charge transport. But it's also the observable where you see most clearly the differences between this case and the familiar ADS-CFT holography. So I first wanted to say a few words from the field theory perspective about what those differences are. So our boundary theory is a non-relativistic theory because I'm treating time and space differently. I can't have any Lorentz boost symmetries. So instead of having a stress energy tensor, it has a stress energy complex. The energy density and the energy flux satisfy some conservation equation, and the momentum density and spatial stress tensor satisfy a conservation equation. But unlike in the relativistic case, there's no relation between energy flux and momentum density. The scaling invariance implies a relation between the energy density and the spatial stress tensor, which is analogous to tracelessness of the stress tensor in the relativistic case. And one can see the differences most strikingly by considering the dimensions of the various components of the stress tensor complex with respect to the scaling symmetry. So energy has dimension z, because T scales to lambda to the zt. So energy density, if I'm in d spatial dimensions, has dimension z plus t. The conservation equation then allows me to read off that the energy flux must have dimension 2z plus d minus 1. The momentum density similarly has dimension 1 plus d, which implies that the spatial stress tensor has dimension z plus d. And these dimensions are consistent with this scaling invariance condition. Notice that in the Lifshitz theory, z plus d is the marginal dimension in d spatial dimensions, because that's the same as the scaling of the volume form. So the energy density and the spatial stress tensor are marginal operators, as they were in the ADS case, but the energy flux and momentum density aren't. Energy flux is an irrelevant operator for z greater than 1, and momentum density is a relevant one. So that makes it quite obvious, quite striking, that there's no relation between EI and PI. It also indicates that considering arbitrary boundary geometries, in whatever sense, arbitrary sources for these operators, is going to be a qualitatively different proposition to what happens in the ADS case.
Is there some restrictions on z?
I'm only going to be interested in z greater than or equal to 1, because that's, I think, what's interesting from the condensed matter side. That corresponds to the speed of light going to infinity. If z was less than 1, it would correspond, roughly speaking, to the speed of light going to 0.
And you impose this Lifshitz scaling symmetry on all momenta and frequencies. In principle,
yes.
You can have z less than 1, provided that, say, it will be like a low energy scaling.
And we'll see that from the point of view of the simplest holographic construction, z greater than 1 is also natural there. Okay.
Sorry, what are the values of z in known examples?
That's a good question. In this strange metals analysis, it looks like z equals 2 is a useful value for modeling. If you have a linear temperature dependence at low temperatures, that can be modeled with a Lifshitz solution with z equals 2. But I think in the systems where they really think there's an IR fixed point, it's just some random value, and it's not necessarily an integer. I don't remember the actual numbers.
Are we eventually going to get to the point where, I mean, it looks like we're going to do the holography next, but you could have thought about this just in terms of hydrodynamics and sort of talking about things like an equation of state and stuff like that.
Sure. So you could do some hydrodynamic analysis here in the context of the field theory. I haven't thought about that in the Lifshitz context, but sure, you could do that. I'm not going to get there.
Is there a natural way? I guess the thing I'm stuck about there is that in the relativistic system, we just say, well, in equilibrium, there's a temperature, and the natural thing to think about is the fluid just sitting there. And then, well, when it starts to move, what we can think of that is, well, we just took a little tube and boosted it. But I'm not sure what to think here. How do I think about that step about boosting it to start the fluid moving doesn't apply here, so.
Good, yes. This is something I thought briefly about, but I don't have anything deep to say. I would say that, yes, unlike in the traditional setup, where once you have the solution for a black hole, which describes a finite temperature fluid at rest, the solution for a black hole, which describes a finite temperature fluid in motion, is obtained just by applying a Boost symmetry. I don't have a Boost symmetry here, so I'm going to have to find that black hole solution. That's going to be another in principle different problem. I have to solve the equation of motion with the appropriate boundary conditions. But I haven't done that. I just thought, okay, that's something you have to do separately in this case. Okay, so let me start talking about holography. So the first part of this is review of other people's work. So first, Kakulu and Mulligan said, this isn't hard. All you need to do is to write down a bulk geometry where I have r to the 2z in front of dt squared instead of r squared, and that provides me with the metric with the appropriate symmetries as isometries. And I can obtain that as a solution of reasonable-looking bulk theories. So in this talk, I want to stay away as much as possible from talking about specific theories, but where I need a specific theory, I'll be talking about this simple theory with a massive vector field, which gives me a Lifshitz solution of this form if I take the parameters in the Lagrangian to look like this and the massive vector to look like that. This theory has been studied by many other people, so finite temperature black hole solutions have been obtained for this theory by these people, including people in this room. And analytic black holes have been obtained for a geometry which asymptotically looks like this in other more complicated theories by these people. There's probably more literature that I haven't remembered to put on my slides. Now, this theory looks fine. This is just a Proca field. It's a perfectly nice theory you'd think would have some natural embedding in string theory. But if you're a skeptic, you say, OK, show me the stringy embedding. And this turned out to be a significantly harder problem than most people at first thought. But stringy embeddings have now been achieved. So there's a nice description in terms of S1 compactifications of M theory. It's originally obtained by Wallerstein and Orion and made more systematic by Donos and Gauntlet, who explained that you can have an 11-dimensional geometry which has a Lifshitz geometry here, a vector here, and some extra scalars, and that in one particular case there was a consistent truncation which gave you a z equals 2 massive vector theory plus extra scalar fields as your 4-dimensional Lagrangian. I'm always going to focus on the case where the bulk spacetime has 4 dimensions, so I have 2 spatial dimensions in my boundary field theory. But there's nothing particularly special about that. I can do whatever dimension you like.
What is
F5? F5 here.
In M series, there's no F5.
Okay, good. Good question. Yes, okay, I've obviously mixed up two sets of equations there. Obviously, what's going on? Okay. Good question. I don't know what my equations mean anymore. But it's all in this nice paper by Donos and Gauntlet, I promise you.
So in this embedding in string series, so there is a Lifshitz solution, and so are there any other solutions which are not Lifshitz?
Well, as I say, in the context of this paper, they wrote down in one specific embedding a consistent truncation, which gave you a 4-dimensional action, which was this massive vector theory plus some extra scalar fields. So presumably, while the black hole solutions were obtained previously might not be solutions of that theory, because the true black hole solutions of this theory probably involve turning on the scalars, there will be black hole solutions. You just need to go and find them. There will be some space of asymptotically Lifshitz solutions in that theory.
That actually is supposed to be a consistent truncation of that theory.
Right. And all of those, anything I find as a solution to this 4-dimensional theory uplifts to solution benefit. Okay, so there's another nice construction by Gregory and collaborators, which is based on massive 2A, compactified on some compact hyperbolic space, and allowing some flux on this compact hyperbolic space, we can construct 4-dimensional Lifshitz solutions with arbitrary values of z up to flux quantization issues. So in this context, it would be nice to work out the full 4-dimensional theory and look at asymptotically Lifshitz solutions. But that's just something to do. I don't think it's going to cause any particular problem.
How can you switch F3 form flux on the Riemann surface? Sorry.
This is not a 3 form. This is the 3 component of an SU2 flux.
Okay, good.
Sorry.
See, there's an SU2 here. Sorry?
Now, to clarify a little bit my question. So there is an effective action which has, given some set of parameters, it has a Lifshitz solution, something that I might think as my field theory data.
Right.
My question is, so is there a way for me to believe that those solutions will be stable was it other solutions with the same field theory data, and so that field theory doesn't want to live in these loop sheets?
So stability is a very interesting issue, which I don't think has been studied yet in any of these Lifshitz theories. The Lifshitz solutions typically don't have any supersymmetry, so stability is very much an open question. But I would be...
ground states?
In this context, no non-alternative ground states, I think. Let me think. Yeah, I think that's true. In this context, there are also ADS solutions. But, you know, I fix my boundary conditions, and that picks out the Lifshitz solution rather than the ADS solution. There are no other known solutions with the same asymptotic boundary conditions. I believe other solutions will exist, because in these very similar theories, black hole solutions were constructed. But stability remains an interesting open question.
And that you fix by hand, much like sort of fixing a mass in this Turing model.
What I fix by hand?
Z.
Yes, I fix Z by hand. Well, Z is related to, in this case, Z is 2. In this case, Z is related to the flux that I chose to put on this compact space, much like N in an ADS construction. Okay, so let me turn now to talk about what we're trying to do, which is to understand what boundary conditions I want to impose. What does asymptotically locally Lifshitz mean? So I want a metric such that the leading order term at large R can, at a point on the boundary at least, be written in this form by some choice of coordinates. So I want the metric to look like the Lifshitz metric plus corrections that are small as R goes to infinity. Because of the different scaling of T and X, it's not possible to describe this using a conformal boundary metric as we did in the ADS case. Instead, it's natural to work with an orthonormal frame. By choice of gauge, I can choose the analog of Gaussian normal coordinates in frame language, and then I require that as R goes to infinity, the time-like frame vector goes like R to the Z E naught hat, where E naught hat has some finite limit, and the space-like frame vectors go like R EI hat, where EI hat has some finite limit. Then, at any point, I can choose coordinates by saying E naught hat is dt, EI hat is dxi, and the metric at a point will asymptotically approach this Lifshitz geometry. Then I can think of the boundary limits of these rescaled frame vectors, E naught hat and EI hat, as my boundary data. And I can make these arbitrary functions of t and x, so I have some arbitrary space-time dependent boundary data for the field theory, which is analogous to the conformal metric on the boundary in the relativistic case. And about the same time we were doing this were Koshava and Melby-Thompson in the context of these field theory, these alternative theories of gravity, where you have some Lifshitz symmetry in the bulk theory, were also proposing that this kind of frame rescaling is a natural way to define conformal boundary data. So since these things are the boundary geometry, in some sense, they should be supplying the sources for the stress tensor. So imagine that I have an action S, which is finite on shell, and whose variations vanish for variations preserving this boundary data. Then I can define an object, which I'll call my stress complex, T alpha B, by saying that the variation of the action is T alpha B times the variation of the bulk frame fields plus terms involving the matter fields. And here I've inserted the matter fields for this massive vector theory because there's an important point to make about the matter fields, which is that I want to do this variation of the frame fields, fixing the matter field with frame indices rather than what I would normally do, which is to fix A alpha, the matter field, with spacetime indices. And the reason for doing that is that it's the extra information that I get, the contribution to this variation from the matter fields, that makes this object not a symmetric tensor. If I did this with pi alpha delta A alpha, this object, even though it looks pretty and frame-like, would actually be a symmetric tensor. And then I haven't gained anything, and I haven't got the extra components that I need for my non-relativistic stress complex. There is one remaining degree of freedom in the matter sector, which is some scalar, is the difference between A naught and its background value. So we want to identify this stress complex with the expectation in the field theory, specifically T alpha 0, the coefficient of variation of the time-like frame field, is giving me my energy density and energy flux, and T alpha j is giving me my momentum density and spatial stress tensor. Defining the stress tensor in terms of the variation of an action always gives you the conservation equations for free. So it was observed by Holmes, Ishibashi, and Maroff in the ADS context that if I assume this S is invariant under boundary diffeomorphisms, it implies that my stress tensor satisfies an appropriate conservation equation, which is the curved space version of these relations here that I wrote down previously. Okay, so that's the prescription for calculating the stress tensor. So I've told you what I mean by asymptotically Lifshitz. I've told you how I want to calculate the stress tensor. Before moving on to discuss spacetimes with these asymptotics, I wanted to make a remark about global structure. So far, my asymptotics have been described totally locally, but in the context of a non-relativistic theory, there's a global constraint you would want to impose. Non-relativistic theories have an absolute time, and so you would expect that I can have the spatial geometry do whatever I like, but that the boundary geometry should have a foliation by preferred surfaces, corresponding to the surfaces of constant absolute time. If I just let E naught hat and E naught hat be anything, this is not what you get. A preferred vector field only defines some preferred set of curves. To get surfaces, you need to require that the time-like frame field is irrotational. That is, this boundary data has E naught hat wedged DE naught hat equal to zero. Up to diffeomorphisms, that's equivalent to saying that the spatial components of this E naught hat are zero. That is, that the sources for EI, the energy flux, vanishes. That's not surprising from the field theory point of view, because I observed earlier that EI was an irrelevant operator. And I would expect that if I add a source, I add some arbitrary source for an irrelevant operator to the field theory, I'm going to change the UV behavior of the field theory. So I had a theory which, on a flat boundary, was a non-relativistic theory. I'm now starting to change the boundary geometry, adding sources for the stress tensor. I can add sources for everything else as much as I like, but if I start adding sources for the energy flux, then my boundary geometry doesn't look globally like I expect it to. So you might say, well, let's set this source to zero, and that's indeed, I think, the right perspective. But you have to keep in mind that you want, like any irrelevant operator, you want to think about introducing that source perturbatively so that you can calculate correlation functions that involve the energy flux.
Why do you care about modifying the UV behavior? Wouldn't you expect some sort of universality to be playing a role here?
Well, it's a question of, why do I care about modifying the UV behavior? Because really, although I have no understanding of the field theory.
But if it's a lattice model, there's a lattice structure there.
Sure.
If it's on a different lattice, then it doesn't matter.
I guess it's because I come from this ADS-CFT perspective, that what I really understand is the field theory. And if I start changing the UV, then I don't know how this space-time is fundamentally defined. And I feel like going from a non-relativistic field theory on flat space to a non-relativistic field theory on some arbitrary geometry is not such a big step. Because I think, okay, so long as the geometry is slowly curved, I understand what I'm doing locally. But going to this other geometry where it doesn't look like it's really globally structured like a non-relativistic field theory would be, well, then I don't really know what this is. And if I had started from the field theory and worked in, that would be fine. I could say, well, I know what this is, it's something different. But I don't know what this is. I don't know what the field theory is specifically in any case. So I'd rather stick to working with the things where I'm doing the generalization that I understand. Okay, so let me tell you about some linearized results. So Omid and I did some analysis, and the linearized equations of motion were done about the same time by Amanda and collaborators. So we take this ansatz, where I'm writing everything in terms of some rescaled functions, and notice that there's just an R here. And the reason I'm doing that is so that the rescaled functions H hat and W and so on are invariant under the asymptotic isometry R goes to lambda inverse R and X and T scaling. So that I can read off the conformal dimensions of the modes that appear in these linearized solutions just from the corresponding powers of R in the rescaled functions. So this guy here is the source for a marginal operator. This is the expectation value for a marginal operator, and so on. So I plug this in. You can see that I'm writing things in terms of scalars, vectors, and tensors with respect to the spatial rotation symmetry. And I get the expected pattern of modes. The scalars have four linearly independent solutions, and there's some coupled system of equations, so I haven't written down the detailed coefficients here. The vectors have another four vector solutions, and the traceless part of the tensor has two solutions of these linearized equations. The life is simplest if you start at the bottom. So in the traceless part of the tensor, I see something that looks very like the structure that you see in the ADS case. You have a constant piece, which is changes in the boundary conditions. That's the source for the spatial stress tensor. And you have a piece that falls off like 1 over r to the z plus 2. So that should be the expectation value of the spatial stress tensor. Similarly, up here, that's the source of the energy density, and that's its expectation value. In here, the powers look a little more complicated. But if you look at the fast fall-off modes first, this guy, which is falling off like 1 over r cubed, should be the expectation value of the momentum density, that's a dimension 3 operator when d is equal to 2. And this guy should be the expectation value of the energy flux. And these other ones are then the sources. So if you take these linearized solutions and you plug them into our prescription for the stress tensor, that's indeed what you find. The energy density, the energy flux, momentum density, and spatial stress have the expectation values. They get finite contributions in those fast fall-off modes in the pattern that you expect. There's one interesting subtlety here, which is that for vectors turning on this mode, this is what I call the fast fall-off mode, and it is the fast fall-off mode for small z. For z near 1, you can see that this is just deforming away from the ADS case where these were marginal. But when z is bigger than 4, this guy is falling off more slowly than this guy. So this isn't really the fast fall-off mode anymore. And what that means is that fixing C4 and letting C2 fluctuate is now analogous to alternative boundary conditions for a scalar field. And indeed, there's a relevant operator, which is PIPI, dimension 6, relevant for z bigger than 4, which generates a flow from the alternative boundary conditions of fixed C4 to fixed C2. And this is similar, the details of this still need to be worked out, but this looks similar to some stuff that was done for Maxwell fields on a fixed Lifshitz background in the paper by Hartnell, Polchinski, Silverstein, and Tong. As I said earlier, there's one remaining scalar degree of freedom in the matter sector. The corresponding scalar operator has this conformal dimension. This is associated with these two modes here that I didn't talk about yet. And its expectation value gets a finite contribution from that guy. So that's the expectation values ignoring the divergent contributions. So in addition to getting finite contributions from the fast fall-off modes, when I turn on arbitrary sources, the expectation values are going to get divergent contributions from the sources, from the slow fall-off modes, which I need to remove by adding some appropriate counterterms. So there are indeed divergences in the on-shell action expectation value from these sources. It turns out there are also divergences in two particular expectation values, in the energy flux and this operator, for z greater than 2, which come from other fast fall-off modes. And There was a very nice paper by Balt van Rees recently, which looked at irrelevant scalar deformations and observed that you also see this kind of structure there, that when you have an irrelevant deformation, you can get divergences not just from the terms that you think of as the boundary data, but from terms where the boundary data is multiplied into the fast falloff modes, because the mode associated with the boundary data grows at large R for irrelevant operators.
So, in some sense, what you were saying is that the theory continues to be divergent depending on the state of the
okay.
So would that kind of relate to the previous questions? So that would imply that you shouldn't be able to renormalize.
Good. So that's exactly the question that Balt addresses in this nice scalar context, where he showed that there are divergent contributions like that, but they're also removed by the local counterterms that you introduce to remove the divergences associated with the sources. So the point is that when you add a counterterm, you add a function of the bulk field. And that includes a contribution from the source and also a contribution from the fast falloff mode. And they precisely cancel the things, the divergences.
You're saying that those counter terms, as normally we do in ABS, are state independent?
Yes.
Both are state independent.
Yeah, there's the way you write the counter terms doesn't depend on the state.
Yeah, that's good.
But they contain information about the
sure.
state because the,
sure.
they contain yes. the subleading part.
Yeah.
Indeed. So there's no general proof of this yet, but it works in the ADS case. Something that's still work in progress from my context is to check that this works in general. In the linearized analysis, we were able to cancel these divergences using covariant local counterterms. So I think it should work here, but I haven't checked it for general arbitrary values of the sources.
Since we are talking, if I have a non-relativistic field theory, just this is as a field theory question, so as a quantum field theory, is it renormalizable or do I have to? I'm sorry for my ignorance.
Is it renormalizable?
Yeah, or is it understood that it's well defined? What's known?
I think some stuff is known in the Schrodinger context. I'm not aware of a lot of discussion of this in the Lipschitz context. And I mean, I think in the Schrodinger context, what I would say is, you know, there are renormalizable theories and there are non-renormalizable theories. But I'm not an expert on the field theory. So. Okay, so let me make a remark about going beyond the linear analysis. So to do this, you want to solve the equations of motion in the asymptotic regime and see that you have some regular series expansion in powers of R. But this is an incredible mess in this case. So it's really important to make use of more elegant techniques. There's a very nice approach due to Papadimitriou and Skinderis, which is basically based on a Hamilton-Jacobi analysis. Instead of solving for the bulk fields in a perturbation expansion in terms of boundary data, determining the divergences that way, and then writing some action in terms of the bulk fields that cancels those divergences, you solve for the action as a function of the bulk fields. And they do this by introducing this dilatation generator, which corresponds to the radial derivative to leading order, but isn't precisely the radial derivative, and you expand in eigenvalues of this dilatation rather than in powers of R. And the punchline for our context is that a regular expansion exists for arbitrary sources for z less than 2, and for zero source for the energy flux and the scalar operator when z is greater than or equal to 2. This isn't surprising. This guy was irrelevant for z greater than 2, so I'm only going to get a UV expansion, which is Lifshitz plus small corrections, if I turn its source off. I observed previously that the energy flux was irrelevant for all z greater than 1, so it's a little bit surprising that I only have to turn its source off when z is greater than or equal to 2 to get a regular UV expansion. But the point is that there is a diffeomorphism symmetry. A constant value of the source for the energy flux is pure gauge. So this guy, the source only appears differentiated. And so it only contributes divergent terms in this expansion once I'm one order higher, roughly speaking. So when the expansion exists, I can calculate the divergent terms in the response functions from this dilatation expansion, and that gives me the divergent terms as an expression, which involves the local field, so I can just cancel it by adding the corresponding term to the action. So if we write, let me go through this quickly. If we write the on-shell action in terms of some lambda, then I can write the dilatation expansion of lambda in terms of the dilatation expansion for the operators, and using the Hamiltonian constraint in the bulk, I can determine the on-shell action in this dilatation expansion. And the term in lambda where delta d is equal to z plus 2 is undetermined, and that's precisely the term corresponding to the finite part of the expectation values of the operators. Okay, so that's the end of what I wanted to say about the Lifshitz. I've got a few minutes left, so I'll say something about Schrodinger, but first let me stop and ask if there are any questions. Alex.
So it looks like you have a final answer for the stress energy tensor, right, for asymptotic Lifshitz.
Yeah.
So now if I take the solution, for example, that Amanda produced, or any other black hole solution, and I compute the stress energy tensor. So one nice check, if that works, the first law of thermodynamics would end up being well-defined with your holographic
simulation. So I did this in the linearized context because the solutions that have been obtained so far fall within that framework, and the energy density that you compute using my framework agrees with what people were calling the energy of these black holes previously.
And that's in agreement
with the first law. Okay. In some papers, that was obtained by some background subtraction calculation. Some other places, it was obtained from the first law directly. But you can obtain the same answer using this prescription.
So that's a nice chart.
Any other questions at this stage? Okay, so let me just say briefly a few words about the Schrodinger case, because this is a little bit different. This is not what I'm currently working on, but I thought it would be interesting to include it in the story. So the idea in Schrodinger, which was actually discussed first before the Lifshitz spacetime was introduced, is that the symmetry is a Galilean symmetry plus this anisotropic dilatation. And this looks like a harder case to get a holographic dual to, because Galilean symmetries are not very natural from the point of view of Einstein gravity. But you can get it using this observation that Galilean symmetry naturally emerges in relativistic field theories by light cone quantization. So you can identify the Galilean boosts with Lorentz transformations involving the x minus direction in some relativistic spacetime where you pick out an x plus and an x minus direction. And you can extend this embedding of the Galilean symmetry to embed the full Schrodinger symmetry in the conformal symmetry in one higher relativistic conformal symmetry in one higher dimension by taking the anisotropic dilatation to be the usual isotropic dilatation plus this factor involving the boost in the x plus x minus plane. So this is a nice kinematic observation at the level of symmetry groups and representations. It means that if you really want to think about a d plus 1 dimensional non-relativistic field theory with Schrodinger symmetry, you're perfectly free to think about it in terms of a d plus 2 dimensional relativistic field theory. And you can just interpret the, so this has a central, this Galilean symmetry has a central element, which is particle number. You just think of the particle number as momentum in this extra direction that you're introducing. And since this now involves the relativistic conformal group, we know how to do the gravitational dual of that. So we can try to obtain a gravitational dual with this by making an appropriate deformation of the anti-de Sitter space in d plus 3 dimensions. So here I have ADS d plus 3 with some x plus x minus light cone coordinates on the boundary, and I introduce this deformation, this r to the fourth dx plus squared, and this respects a scaling symmetry where x plus scales like lambda squared x plus, so this you have r squared x plus everywhere, and x minus is unaffected by the scaling symmetry. And that's this anisotropic dilatation in the case z equals 2. So this is a bulk geometry which has Schrodinger symmetry. Unfortunately, to get the extra Galilean boost, we had to introduce an extra dimension. This is a solution of a theory with a massive vector again, now with a light-like component of the vector turned on. And an interesting issue about this extra dimension is that you'd really like this to be a discrete quantum number from the field theory point of view. And that's easy to achieve. I just make the corresponding dimension periodic, then its momentum is quantized. But x minus periodic might be okay in the field theory, where I'm thinking about this as some kinematical convenience. But it's going to cause me queasy feelings in the bulk spacetime, where now I have some compact null direction.
Could you not put Dirichlet boundary conditions on it?
Okay, that's an interesting idea. Then I would have, I'd have additional boundaries of the space-time, and I would have to think about what I wanted to do with the boundary data on those boundaries, but it's an interesting proposal. Okay, so one of the nice things about the Schrodinger context is that the Schrodinger case with two spatial dimensions can naturally be obtained in string theory. There's a solution-generating transformation, which I can use to turn ADS5 cross S5 into a geometry which has this Schrodinger solution as a factor. And that's nice because it means I get for free a lot of asymptotically Schrodinger geometries in analytic form. So, for example, if I take Schwarzschild ADS and apply this same solution-generating transformation, I get an asymptotically Schrodinger black hole solution.
With a closed loop curve or without, or is it an option?
Sorry?
So when you do this story, do you necessarily have to have a closed loop curve, or is that an option?
It depends what you want. But if you want n discrete, modulo the interesting suggestion that we can try Dirichlet boundary conditions on the x minus direction. But you need to do something to x minus if you want n to be discrete.
Okay. The transformation story doesn't require that.
Yeah. No, the TST doesn't require a closed null curve. And indeed, if I'm doing TST here in this black hole solution, x minus is not null. It's space-like in the bulk, although it is asymptotically null. The circle is going to zero size at the boundary. So the problem is not as severe in the black hole solution as it was in the vacuum solution, but there are still concerns about that periodic identification. So these black holes form a two-parameter space of solutions. There is one parameter R plus that I had in Schwarzschild ADS, and there's one parameter which defines which direction I'm doing this transformation with respect to. And these are physically interpreted as temperature and particle number in the field theory. The geometry has an interesting slow falloff behavior, where the black hole solution had terms that fell off like 1 over R to the fourth. The asymptotically Schrodinger black hole has terms that fall off like 1 over R squared.
Why do you want it to be compact? Because particle number in this case is conserved.
Sorry?
This is a conserved number. It's to be an integer.
So you say just choose it to have an integer value.
Other different values stop each other.
Yeah, maybe. I don't have anything particularly deep to say about that. So you can apply the same prescription for calculating the stress tensor in this context. And if you apply it to this black hole solution, you get the answers you expect. The energy density is given by R plus to the fourth, as are the non-zero spatial stresses. And you could extend the prescription to calculate a particle number density, and that's given by this combination which appears in the slow falloffs. More generally, for solutions obtained by TST from vacuum ADS solutions, the stress tensor given by this prescription, which is entirely constructed on the asymptotically Schrodinger side, actually agrees with the ADS stress tensor, the solution that you apply the TST transformation to. So that's another nice check that this is a reasonable definition of the stress tensor. Okay, so let me come to the end. What I wanted to argue in this talk was that this non-relativistic problem is an interesting and challenging extension of our usual notions of holography. The Lifshitz solutions are interesting. You get a simple space-time dual of field theories with this symmetry, and these solutions have now been embedded in string theory. But what I'm working on is showing that you can construct a holographic dictionary in a way that's very similar to the familiar ADS-CFT case. There are changes in what you think of as your boundary data, and there are these interesting differences where components of the stress tensor are no longer marginal operators, but you can apply the same idea. You can have a collection of local counterterms which remove the divergences and get finite expectation values for the stress tensor from the asymptotic falloffs of the bulk metric in the way that you expect. This is now pretty much under control for z between 1 and 2. For z greater than 2, there are still some outstanding issues, so this is still very much work in progress. The picture may change. So I'll stop there.
Rob. What about, I mean, all of this is when it's spatially, the x parts are spatially flat. It's,
oh, no, absolutely not.
Oh, I thought
absolutely anything you want. So locally, looks like this. Globally, any function of x you like. In fact, the spatial geometry is any arbitrary function of t and x. All I'm imposing is that it's locally flat. So I'm saying
you can replace that dx squared with the d omega squared.
Yeah. Yes. So what I'm saying is, I want at any point there to be some coordinate system t and x. So this is the same as saying if I had an ADS case, then I have r squared g alpha beta dx alpha dx beta. Well, at any point in a metric, I can always choose coordinates so that g alpha beta is eta alpha beta at a point. So what I was trying to impose here was the analog of that condition.
Okay.
This is purely a local condition at a point in the boundary. So the overall geometry in the boundary, which is encoded in these E naught hat and EI hat, is some arbitrary function of T and X.
Like the spherical, hyperbolic,
yeah,
or
whatever.
So that's the beauty of using the orthogonal frames that you only require is that the idea of a frame makes sense.
Yeah.
Geometry is locally, just give me a calculus and then you can get on.
Yeah. Yeah. So my geometry is locally this. And globally, you know, global geometry is encoded in these frame fields.
Can you formulate this perturbation theory to compute correlation functions, also do the boundary theory as some kind of Witten diagram generalization, like some new propagator?
So indeed you can. I mean, whether you think in terms of the Witten diagrams or in the language that I've been using here, it's really a question of how you solve the bulk equations of motion, right? So the Witten diagrams is a way of solving the bulk equations of motion, the perturbation theory around a fixed background. Here what I'm saying is I'm not taking any position on what's happening deep in the bulk. I only want to understand the asymptotics and the relation between the asymptotic falloffs of bulk fields and the correlation functions. So you put a source here, and there's some response in the bulk field over here, and I say there's some appropriate scaling limit that tells me what the two-point function is. And I haven't said anything about how I calculate what that response is for a given source, because that would involve talking about the bulk geometry, and there you have to be more specific. I'm trying to be very general.
But can you compute like three-point function or four-point function?
Sure. I mean, actually, that's been done. That was done in the original in the vacuum background. That was done in the original paper by Kakrilu and Mulligan. If you want to do that now, say in the finite temperature background, then you're going to have to solve and find out what the bulk of the boundary propagator is in that numerically determined black hole solution, and that's not going to be a lot of fun, right? I mean, what I've done is the easy part, in a certain sense. I've only solved the equations of motion in the asymptotic region, where life is simple. Deep in the interior, who knows what's going on in an arbitrary geometry?
Is there a non-solution with it's asymptotically usually DS, but there's some stuff in the bar that become this Lifshitz type when it belongs to the idea?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a There's a rich literature on this kind of thing. Amanda is the right person to ask about that kind of solution.
Wouldn't that would take out the Dolgov in that space automatically?
So this is an approach that I consider to say, okay, let's start from ADS where we know what we're doing. And if I had some Lipschitz region in the IR, then you'd say, okay, well, so by integrating in from the ADS prescription for holographic normalization, I can figure out what the Lipschitz prescription for holographic normalization is. But if the Lipschitz region is some finite distance in RG, then I think I need to understand integrating in and the Wilsonian version of ADS-CFT better than it currently is understood. It seemed easier to me to just start from scratch. Say, I know how this works in the ADS case, let's come up with a similar prescription for Lipschitz boundary conditions.
Principally, you would not expect, if you have a flow in which Lipschitz arises, in some sense, dynamically, you shouldn't expect any modification to a holographic randomization, right? Because holographic randomization is simply a prescription to remove divergences, which are a UV property. So as long as you have a relativistic theory, it means a UV.
No, I think I understood the question to be, what if I took my usual relativistic prescription in the UV and I integrated in to figure out what the prescription was once I've thrown away the UV part of the geometry?
I didn't know how to do it.
Well, indeed, that's what I was saying.
Even in ADS.
That's what I was saying. I don't think our understanding of Wilsonian RG is at a level where we can do that.
But if we have a flow, and it just so happens that the infrared is have, you know, yeah, asymptotically Lipschitz geometry, then the standard holographic randomization will work, and all we have to do is just focus on the infrared features.
So that's obviously another way that you can deal with Lipschitz things is by saying, well, let me only talk about them embedded in some UV relativistic theory, and I think that's an approach Amanda's been taking in some of her recent work.
Lundberg, which was at the Chicago Great Lakes meeting that I was at 2.5 weeks ago, I think it was Trancanelli, the postdoc who was working with Mateus, gave a talk claiming to have an actual string theory embedding of a Lipschitz-like story, but they actually introduced, they took a model with D3 brains and introduced D7 brains wrapped in a 5-sphere and sphered over one of the spatial directions in the world volume, and constructed solutions in a very, very similar way to what we did. I think probably the analysis that Simon was talking about might cover that case as well. But it's not clear if the solutions they're looking at are supersymmetric. Seems to me they're not. And they're unstable. They actually find thermodynamic instabilities in the field theory that correspond to real instabilities of the bulk geometry. So, you know, there are some cases where instability information is known, but...
Yeah, but what I would say is, from my perspective, it may operationally be sufficient to do what you suggest and just work with some spacetime which ultimately has an ADS UV.
Which is what we expect in real world, by the way. So we'll lots of Lipschitz scalings, they arise in some critical phenomena. However, we believe that the ultimate description, if we believe in string theory,
yeah, but you have
well,
to
be some relativistic. Yeah.
You have to go through the lattice to get there in the real world.
Well, for example, what Amanda was mentioning, I know specific examples where you have an explicit emerging Lipschitz critical phenomena scaling. Of course, it's not a zero temperature, sort of not the vacuum, it's a thermal, which is also what people often.
But let me say what I was going to say, which was that while operationally that may be perfectly adequate, from the point of view of learning something new about holography, I think this is more interesting. And it turns out you can do it this way. So then operationally you have choices. You can either do things in some ADS context, or you can use this formulation and work directly with the infrared physics.
Well, but then I wish there would be some better understanding the way that it's not clear to me that we can, it's beautiful that it works and it kind of the simple tests that you can imagine it immediately passes, but I still have this nagging feeling that I would like to understand why those field theories that you're talking about, I should be able to renormalize this quantum field theories.
Okay, that's an interesting question. So, I don't have anything to say.
That may be you mention issues whether my UV boundary conditions that you are imposing are stable.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
They'll show up in the big grid and two-story that you still have done one twice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's find Simon again.